Welcome to the Family Office Real Estate Institute podcast, where we explore family offices, real estate, and the art of preserving legacies and wealth. I'm DJ Van Kuren, and I'm going to be utilizing my experience of investing on behalf of a number of prominent families and working directly for a number of prominent families on their real estate portfolio. I'm going to tap into my decades worth of experience in real estate investing and relationships with some of the most prominent family office leaders in the industry, academics from universities around the world, and industry experts and leaders in the real estate space. So whether you're a family member, family office executive, family office, or real estate enthusiast, the Family Office Real Estate Institute podcast will empower you with knowledge and influential voices. I'm DJ Van Kuren, and this is the Family Office Real Estate Institute podcast. All right. Well, welcome to another edition of Family Office Real Estate Insights. We have Louis Dublin from Red Brick with us today. Louis, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
So today I want to talk about a couple things that are on people's mind. We just had a conversation actually earlier today about some OZ stuff, so I might ask you some of those questions as well. But, you know, in order to give a little bit of a framework, I guess, to this conversation, what are the areas that you guys are focusing on today?
We are developing close to 2,000 residential units in Washington, D.C., housing units, rentals. Most of those rental units are market rate. There's a portion of them that are affordable workforce, but most of them are market rate housing.
Okay. And so I'm going to ask you, you know, today is the, we're already into March, if you can believe that. And, you know, we've been dealing with issues, in the economy. Rising interest rates, obviously, you know, people that were getting very nervous going into the end of the year. And I personally am seeing a lot more people that are actually getting back in, you know, they're feeling more comfortable as well. But you still have those people that are like, well, I want to hold off and not invest right now. And, you know, with the largest family office real estate study we do, we're starting our fifth year. For the last 4 years, over 70% of families have wanted to invest in a multifamily, right? So with these 2,000 rental units that you have, you know, what are you seeing going into the beginning of this year? And if I'm saying, well, I'm worried because of interest rates, right? And with what's happening in the economy, what would you say to me on that?
Sure. Well, there's a couple strategies we employ that are really faring us well right now. One of them is very low leverage. We historically and today don't leverage land. So when we acquire something, we tend to do it with 100% equity. Occasionally we'll have a working capital line, but typically we own land, at least on the initial acquisition, typically on an all cash basis, no debt. Second, and that low leverage helps us both on the acquisition side, and once we go into construction, we typically leverage less than 40% to construction debt. Very atypical model, which is one of the reasons we were the only groups to get a construction loan over $100 million non-recourse this fall on a $430 million project that we're currently building of multifamily rentals in DC. So low leverage is a very major a part of the strategy today. A year ago, a year and a half ago, I'd be asked the question, are you crazy? 40% leverage. Why aren't you employing more debt? It's so accretive to you. And we always felt that the day would come when the markets turned. Second, we are not merchant builders. We are 10 to 20 year holders of assets. So this is a cycle. No question there's insecurity out there, but we have a very long view. And that long view historically, when you also do the research and the math, if you've got an investment pace where you've got a certain percentage of your portfolio in alts and a certain percentage of that in real estate. Let's just say the real estate allocation is 10%. I'm making up a number, but that's probably not too far off that a lot of the larger institutional and family offices would use. And you're pacing. Well, very few people that are very successful long-term know how to market time. I don't know how to market time. Not with something that takes a couple of years to build, develop, stabilize. And so with this long view, and many of the more sophisticated investors out there continuing their pacing. Now, some of those dollars may be going into debt funds as opposed to equity investments, for instance. So this little fall off, and we're probably at 60 to 70% of the normal pace that we raise capital in. We have our own white label, as I think you know, DJ, a broker-dealer on the capital market side internally. So we raise a lot of our own capital, and we sit on a number of wealth management platforms historically, including UBS, Alex Brown, Raymond James, insurance companies, about 30 RIAs. And then we have a lot of direct relationships with the ultra high net worth family office network that we're part of. The pacing of dollars in is down. What do I say to people that say, I'm not so sure right now? I think a lot of those people are looking for discounts. They're looking for deals, you know, broken deals and things like that. And that's not what we do. So they're probably not for us right now.
So when you get into, so if you're doing the 40% on the development side, once it's stabilized, are you going above that? And are you using agency debt?
Excellent question, of course. But typically we'll go to 60, 65. Okay. We just think it's prudent to leverage as little as possible until you've started enjoying cash flow. And by definition, we're not going to be going for the agency debt until we've stabilized. So we now have reliable cash flow to pay debt service.
You know, one of the things, ironically, you know, I've known about you guys since 2003, I think it was. And that's when you guys had put together one of the first single family private equity plays, right? Mm-hmm. And I was doing the same thing. And that's why I knew exactly who you guys were and everything you were doing at the time. And one of the things that I learned at that time when we were accumulating properties was that my number was about 70%. And so I was like, as long as you are able to maintain with a certain vacancy rate and you can make those payments, it doesn't matter if the value goes to zero, because you're able to continue to pay that debt and continue on, and it would eventually come back up. And, you know, the low leverage, you definitely, I'm sure you hear it and you have heard it all the time. Like you said, why aren't you leveraging up? The first patriarch I worked for, he would leverage as high as he could go, right, in order to maximize returns. But there's definitely something to be said, you know, about, you know, this lower leverage. It definitely mitigates a lot of risk.
We have no tolerance for a structure that gives us the potential to lose capital. Doesn't mean we will never lose capital, but we are allergic to the thought of loss of capital. So a lot of our structuring is around preserving capital. Do we give up some yield for doing that? Of course, sure. But over the long term, we are convinced that it's highly accretive to the overall returns. And I think a lot of people sleep well at night with lower leverage these days.
What are you seeing? Now, you've been through some cycles. Are you seeing, you know, any similarities over the last? I mean, we haven't hit, quote unquote, a recession. And you know, for me, looking back historically, I don't see us going into another recession on the real estate side to 27, 28, but have you seen this movie before over this last 6 months that we've been on?
Yeah, the movie is, you know, a lot of sort of insecurity, some panic, that'll create some buying opportunities. What I haven't seen in a long time, this run-up in rates, I don't think most of us had for a long time. That's sort of been interesting. One interesting thing, there is little to no similarity except for the anxiety levels. And when I first started in the late 80s, early 90s, and as you may remember, DJ, after law school, I went to work for the feds. I was the Resolution Trust Corporation, which was the cleanup agency for the failed savings and loans at that time. And it was all distress. And it was pre-alt. You didn't even use the alts world, I think, back then. And real estate was a four-letter word. It was a bad word. It was an asset that people certainly didn't know what to do with, and the cap rates were different and all that. Nowhere near that. I think that most institutions have 10 to 20% allocations into real estate today. I've been on the board of New York Common for over 15 years, one of the largest pension funds in the United States. We talk about this all the time. The controller or sole trustee is asking all the time to our board, you know, what's similar here? You know, what are the warning shots? We refer a lot back to fall of 2008 into 2009-10 and the structural problems there. I don't think we have the structural problems. There weren't a lot of stupid deals that got financed and built. Doesn't mean we can't find some, but you didn't have this free money and this recklessness on the part of the banks. There was a lot of governors there, you know, somewhat governing and mitigating and tempering, I should say, the pace of dollars into projects. Multifamily became the darling of everyone. So did industrial and distribution. Those were not asset classes that were widely known up until we changed the way we buy things and have them delivered to our homes. Yeah. So I don't know. There's a lot out there. There's a lot of anxiety like 2008-09. But I don't think you have the same structural problems where there was goofy lending on the consumer side and goofy lending on the real estate side, and now you've got to pay the piper. I don't think we're in that time.
So I can tell you, in the average, you know, from our studies, the average allocation by a family is just over 24%, so about 24.5%, and it definitely is an asset class, right? And it's really have done that. You know, one of the things that I think was really relevant during the recession was that a lot of families waited until the end in order to come in. And so they missed a lot of that upside, where during COVID and now they've been saying, okay, let's build up some dry powder and let's hold off a little bit, right? But you still have, you know, Chris Keenan, who's, you know, works with the Best Buy family. He's on our board at the Four Institute. And I don't know if you heard him speak, you know, talk about this last time, but he was saying he was talking to somebody, you know, in the banking area at the top, and they were saying, we're not going to be bailing people out this time. And there's definitely, you know, some distress that has been coming to the market. And, you know, there's a lot of people really believe that that's just going to continue to happen, especially because people either had floating rates or negative leverage type of thing. What do you think, if any, will that do to the market if that actually does happen, where you have all these bad debts that are happening with the multifamily? And, you know,
I think what you're talking about predominantly is the office and perhaps some of the retail sector. That's where I see, you know, keys being given back and sponsors not being bailed out. And I think that it's going to be very interesting how many of those assets can be converted to a different use, whether it's industrial or residential or some kind of experiential retail. I don't know what they all get converted to. I think it'll depend on where you are and situationally, or scraped for land value. I think that the office sector generally and the retail sector are difficult places to be, with the exception of grocery anchored retail that fared very, very well during the COVID meltdown and has fared well. But most of the asset types in retail have not fared so well. The office sector in general, you know, the AAA plus buildings, you know, still have a core following in the institutional world. Anything below that, oh my gosh. So I wouldn't want to own Class B office buildings and looking to recap or something of that sort. There are a lot of institutions that aren't even lending to office today. So I think it all depends on the sector you're talking about. I don't really see it in multifamily. Yes, there'll be deals where rescue capital is needed, where there's negative leverage, where there's some transitional problem or issue or short or medium term issue. But I don't see a lot of structural weakness in multifamily. The demand's there. And fewer people can afford to buy homes. What was happening in our multifamily portfolios is some of those portfolios in strong markets were being denuded of tenants because rates were so low, those tenants were buying houses. That ain't happening today. So a lot of people that are in these upper middle income and even luxury multifamily units are sort of stuck there for a while because their costs of borrowing have increased in some cases 50, 60, 70%.
I mean, I still, you know, if you started getting multifamily after 2012, you know, I believe if you couldn't make money, then you've got a big problem, right? Because things have continued to go up. And from that too, I think a lot of people have jumped in the game, not having the experience like you guys, but have come in and said, okay, I'm going to do multifamily, but yet they've never been through cycles. They've never planned accordingly, whether it's low leverage or understanding that. Don't you think some of that's going to come back and sort of bite some of these people that,
sure, you know? But that tends to be smaller deals. Yeah. Usually larger capital doesn't come to a newbie. Tends to be. Doesn't mean all will be. And that's why I was saying there will be some rescue capital, some capital that's going to be needed to bail out that situation you were just describing. But I think it's a lot less in multifamily than in office and retail, where you've and in some of the hospitality sectors where you've got structural and market distress. You don't have market distress in most markets in multifamily.
Right. So let me go. I'm going to go over to the OZ side because I got a couple of questions on that. Sure. You guys doing multifamily in the OZ areas as well?
That's our main asset type is multifamily buildings in our opportunity. I'm sitting on the virtual balcony of one of our buildings in Washington, D.C.
It's a great view. So when you know, the OZs came out, and I was having a conversation earlier this morning, you know, they were taking a long time in order to solidify the regulations and all the guidelines and the rules, right? And so that has caused a lot of people, or that had caused a lot of people, to not invest and to sort of hold back. And then there's all these components that people were talking about, you know, how great it was going to be. And, you know, we've seen some areas that have actually where there's been growth that sort of even pushed out some of the people that they were trying to improve the area for. Do you feel that the OZ is actually happening the way that people expected it, as in the benefits for whether it's the communities and, you know, what it's doing in those areas?
Without question. The workforce development opportunities, the affordable housing that's been built, the job growth that's happened in communities, the food desert conditions that now have some vibrancy to them, the healthcare deserts. We just finished an OZ office building, or an office building in an OZ, for a regional healthcare provider in an area that had little to no services like that. So it's like, I feel like we're blessed being able to do work like that. So yes, absolutely. It's workforce development, it's jobs, it's affordable housing. In most cities, if you do anything of any scale or size, you're getting inclusionary zoning by doing a certain percentage of your units affordable. They give you more FAR, basically.
Yep.
So it's working. It's working. It's from policy side, it's creating more affordable housing and those other things that I just mentioned. So I see the benefits of this economic activation capital every day. Remember, you're getting an after-tax 400 to 500 basis point yield, 400 to 500 basis point more on an after-tax basis if you're within an opportunity zone and you're in a qualified opportunity zone business. So it's big. It's big.
Now, the date for those, some of those benefits for people to get in is coming up, right? In a number of years. I think we're, what, four years?
So it sunsets in 2026. That means your money must be in by 2026.
Right. Do you think that the government's going to extend that out?
So I met this fall with Senator Scott and Senator Booker. I'm on the industry trade coalition called EIG. And we had meetings up on the Hill. And you tell me, we've got a wacky Washington these days. Both, you know, Booker and Scott are red and blue. There is bipartisan support to extend the date by 2 years and the benefits. I think it's highly likely that that will be accomplished. I can't tell you in what bill it'll be tacked onto or when, but I think it's highly likely. It's working too well. It's working too well not to. And there's huge bipartisan support. And there's a couple of squeaky wheels, you know, on the far left side of things that, you know, want it to only be for 100% affordable housing for things that are just not economically practicable.
Yeah, we had, you know, a lot of the families that I know, they weren't really taking advantage of it initially because they were waiting for the regs. But that seems to have loosened up where bigger checks
are being written. The regs are definitive today.
Yeah, exactly.
It took like over 2 years.
Yeah.
But the regs are definitive. We know how to structure it. We're one of the largest in the country, having done many, many large opportunity zone funds. I'm optimistic that they will push the sunset date.
One of the things that it's, you know, the word fund, whenever you hear the word fund, you think of investing into, you know, multiple properties where their definition of fund is also just an individual project, right?
Well, it's not my definition.
No, not your definition. I'm saying the policy.
Yes, it's a bad word. It's a really bad word.
That's right.
In OZ, a little learning for some of your audience, in OZ, the only legal way to invest and get the tax benefits around an opportunity zone investment is to do it within a geographic zone and to do it in a qualified opportunity zone business in a zone, in a fund format. And at the end of the day, what's so crazy is most of our funds are funds of one, occasionally two pre-identified assets we're going to develop. Right. Usually you think of fund being multiple assets, as you said, and blind pool. We are pre-identified and we're usually one large asset per fund. And that's just a creature of the Treasury regs having to call it a fund. It's a terrible word.
It is. But my understanding too is that there's also been discussion of possibly being able to have, you know, fund of funds, right? So, or a fund. And do you, after talking to these people, do you think that that's a possibility that might
absolutely
actually
work? I think that if which I'm highly optimistic, the 2026 date will be moved to 2028. One of the number of provisions that the industry has been lobbying, and I think there's consensus on, is the fund of funds.
Yeah.
So that someone that invests in a qualified opportunity zone fund will be able to invest in multiple funds like us. Right now, that's prohibited.
Yeah, the way you get it,
there is a workaround, and that is a lot of people, large family offices, are investing in, not in the fund up here, but in the qualified opportunity zone business down below. And we've done that probably half a dozen times.
So can you elaborate a little bit on that? So when you're saying investing into the business down low, are you saying that they're investing into a business that's in the OZ and that business is then investing into multiple projects?
No. There's a fund structure where the fund sits on top, the entity of the fund. And just below the fund is an entity that is the qualified opportunity zone business. Okay. We can allow, and the rules allow us to admit other opportunity zone funds to invest in the QOSB, the Qualified Opportunity Zone business, but not in the upper tier fund itself.
I gotcha. Okay. Well, I honestly think that if they go to this fund to funds type structure, it's going to even bring more money in.
Absolutely. Right now it's prohibitive. Like we won't even do it for under $3 million.
Yeah.
Because the big deal is a lot more paperwork and a lot more process and ops and things of that sort. So it's really been reserved for the bigger dollars coming in. But if they go to what you've just what we both are talking about, a fund of funds, I think you'll have not mom and pops, but I think you'll have high net worth investors doing this as well.
What so you have a project in Hudson Yards, is that right?
No.
Where's your project, your OZ? We were talking about a little bit before.
We have a number of them, but our largest one is in Washington, D.C., in the Bridge District, right across from the ballpark and the new soccer stadium. About $30 billion of development has occurred across the bridge. This side of the bridge is deemed Opportunity Zone. And those tax-efficient dollars were essential for investors, not only believing in what we were doing, but being economically rewarded for taking that belief.
Yeah, because one of the things, where was it in New York? I know that there's a location in New York that had an OZ. I'm not sure if it was the Hudson Yards, but
I think it was. My recollection is you're right. It's strange and quirky. I think that's because the old horse stables were there.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is that there's a handful of locations around the country that really shouldn't have been necessarily an OZ, but they were.
But those are the headline assets. For the most part, this program has worked unbelievably well.
Right. Yeah, here in Denver, actually, part of the where the football stadium is for the Broncos is actually in an OZ. And, I know there's a lot of great development that's going to be buttoned up against that. You know, I wonder if the Waltons, who bought the team, if that was part of the deal. I mean, I don't know. I haven't heard of that. But, you know, there's definitely some huge benefits. And when you have that availability and button up against the stadiums, like you're saying, it's just going to drive additional, the economy just in that local area.
Absolutely.
Have you seen many, I know you've been focused on real estate, but have you seen, other than you mentioned about the business component of an OZ business, have you seen any VC firms in these OZ areas come up?
No one of real note. I've seen some businesses that have gotten capitalized in vertical farming, for instance, mm-hmm. where they've taken over some old dilapidated buildings in Philadelphia. And they're literally doing, micro farming in the building, which is sort of cool. Mm-hmm. There have been some hydroponic farms. There have been some wind farms that have been done in OZs, which is sort of interesting.
Mm. I hadn't heard about the wind farms, but that's very interesting.
Yeah, wind farms, vertical farming. There have been some biology and virology research, some research companies that have set up their companies and labs, that's venture related, because if they have a big new drug or a big new discovery and they become a $1 billion business, they're in a very tax efficient place in terms of their gain. But that's the one part of OZ that really hasn't seen a lot of action, is the actual businesses themselves. So the fault is multifamily apartment buildings. We easily achieve the substantial improvement test when you build something new. If you renovate something, it has to be at least 50% of the value of the shell you're renovating. So if you do a massive gut rehab too, that would sort of work in a lot of places. But new build multifamily tends to work in every one of these geographies deemed OZ.
Yeah. So I have one more question for you before we finish up, and then we'll have to talk in greater detail at another time. But so, you know, one of the questions we were talking about right before we went on was, we have the rising interest rates, you know, cap rate expansion is starting to happen. Why should people still invest today in a multifamily? Why not wait? Why now?
Well, the big lesson I learned at Common many years ago was 2009, when I was on the board of one of the largest pension plans in the country. We were scared to death. We didn't know what was happening in 2009. And we paused and we stopped for a year and a half, 2 years. It took us 10 years to catch up to all the market indexes of what our peers were doing in terms of return. Those that kept their pacing, kept their discipline, kept their, you know, underwriting, they were being more selective, but kept their underwriting, tremendously outperformed, and you could feel that for 10 to 20 years. Those people that kept their pacing and kept their conviction, that didn't mean that all their dollars still went into the same assets. Of course not. You know, there were debt funds that were created. There were, you know, other asset classes to go into. Multifamily will always be, you know, the commodity food stuff, real estate. It's understandable. People got to live somewhere. There are times where more people rent than buy. Some of that structural, what interest rates are and can they afford to buy. In higher interest rate environments, I think apartments will continue, as they have historically, to do better because there's more demand. Less people can leave their apartment and go buy a house. Mm-hmm. And we have a huge shortage of multifamily, as you probably know, DJ, in most American major markets. So that short supply, that I think increasing demand, because again, less people are able to buy, make this again a very defensible and resilient asset class. So maybe I'm very partial to it, but makes all the sense in the world to me.
Well, one of the things that I've continued to say, well, I mean, look, you can make money in any market, right? Whether it's stocks, whether it's real estate, but it has to be good decisions. You have to go down to the fundamentals. And you know, one of the things that you guys are doing, to be honest with you, is because you're, having low debt. I mean, that you don't see that all the time. You see people leveraging as much as they can. And you know, you're protecting your downside when you tell me about the amount of debt that you're using and everything else. And you know, historically, the lowest vacancy rate's ever been 11% in multifamily. And you can definitely absorb that on the low leverage.
And in DC, we don't have those ups and downs. And we're a unique city. Federal workers, and by default, culturally, most of the companies here pass on the cost of living increases each year in one salary. So people say to me, well, how do you hedge for inflation? You want to hedge for inflation, come to DC. It's by its very definition, the way people are paid here is linked to inflation rates. So this is a very resilient market. I think it's one of the reasons that we fare extremely well in recessions.
I did not know that. That's fantastic. You know, and once again, that's just protecting the downside. So Louis Dublin, Red Brick, thank you so much for going over this today. I think it's you answered a lot of questions that I know are in people's mind. And, you know, your longevity in the space is obviously, you know what you're doing. You've been through some cycles. You've seen some stuff. And, you know, staying on the fundamentals and that same question that people have, which is why now? And you brought up a lot of points too, that I think why 70%, once again, of families over 70% continue to look into that multifamily sector. And, you know, as long as the fundamentals there, and that's the biggest thing, you got to make sure you dive in with who you're working with. And I think it's also extremely important before the deal can be the best deal in the world, but if that company can't implement, it doesn't matter. right, sure. on that deal as a whole. So thanks so much for being on the show. We will have you back. We'll have, we'll talk about some other information and where we are, but you've definitely answered a lot of questions for us today.
Thank you so much. Be well. I look forward to seeing you soon.
All right. Bye-bye.